We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
What do you think about the Laker team now?
You follow the box scores, the games every day.
Just the Lakers.
You're kidding. That is really a compliment. I was pleased to see you smile at the top of our show, because once the game starts, you have a game face. You don't smile much out there.
I don't think you have to do things for money anymore.
Correct.
What's up, Laker fans? Welcome to the Laker Film Room Podcast, brought to you by the Blue Wire Podcast Network. I'm Pete, joined by Darius and Mike. And today we're going to talk about the new shooters that the Lakers added to the squad, specifically Malik Monk and Wayne Ellington. I'd like to start with Ellington. He's somebody that, again, a common theme on this roster. This is his second tour of duty with the Lakers. And he, one of the things I like about this combo of Ellington and Monk is they go about their shooting in a different way. Ellington is a total technician. He knows how to lean on a guy and run off of a screen. And he's got this great pump fake that sends guys flying. He's a wonderful pull-up shooter. But in terms of the skills that you can get better at in terms of shooting, Wayne Ellington has really added to his game since his last tour of duty with the Lakers, where he knows all the tricks of the trade. Now, he's got a ton of holes in his game, but Darius, when it comes to pure shooters in the NBA, whether it's off of a screen, off of a pull-up jump shot, Wayne Ellington's right up there amongst the better shooters in the game. What do you see that we're getting in him?
Look, man, go back and watch the game. It might have been in Detroit where the Lakers played the Pistons this past season.
Yeah, it was Detroit, yeah.
Wayne Ellington kicked the Lakers' ass. Him and Blake Griffin played two-man game. Just all night, it felt like. And handoff action, like rub, cut back, come back around, bounce pass, right? Pump fake, sidestep, another three. Like, oh, you're trying to hold me. I'm faking like I'm cutting back door. Nope, circling back. I'm coming back across. He was really managing space well. And if there's an idea that I think matters with any shooter, it's how do you navigate the labyrinth of perimeter defense and screen navigation in order to get to a spot where you can get your jumper off. And the thing that I've seen from Ellington that I like is he does have a lot of that stuff down. He does know how to move off of the ball. And I think it's super important for a guy who is not like an elite athlete. That's how you stick in this league, is I know how to hand fight. I know how to rub off at the right angle from a screen. And I know how to then set my feet, plant that inside foot if I'm coming to my strong hand, or fade and drift if I'm going away from my strong hand and get the shot off with minimal space. Ellington, what I like about him, and Mike, you've mentioned this on a few different pods, but that his shot profile isn't that he's just a camper who is sitting in the weak side corner or strong side corner. He is someone who can shoot from above the break. And I feel like from the Lakers' perspective, and Pete, you can get into the X's and O's of this a bit more, but That above the break three is super important for the type of offense that the Lakers run. And so, Mike, do you think that that's one of the more important skills that Ellington brings to the table as a shooter? Like Pete talked about the technical stuff, but I think shot location and where he's comfortable taking and hitting threes from is just as important as his proclivity as a shooter in general.
Oh, easily. And there, so let me start with the Laker game. And that, so that game, he went 6 for 9 from three and he only took 12 shots. He scored 20 points. And it was one of those games where the Lakers just thought they had going in. And then, yeah, part of it was Blake, but a lot of it was Ellington. But I remember doing a story on him during that game because he was the hottest shooter in the league heading into that game. So these are his 3-point make totals going back like 8 games from there. 3 for 5, 7 for 11, 4 for 9, 6 for 10, 4 for 6, 6 for 9, 4 for 8, and then the 6 for 9. And that's just from three. So he was on a heater at that point, and everything, the rim was looking huge. And you could tell by the way that you described, Darius, it was like step back to the right, fine, up fake, step inside, boom, around the screen. It didn't matter. And so what I see, we'll get to this in a second, but forget defense, forget any other weaknesses. Just put him on the court at certain times with LeBron, with Westbrook, with AD, and just like take advantage of the playbook. He opens up all of the offensive coaches, yes, in what they want to draw up, because you can draw anything you want when a guy is, and again, I don't even care if the shot's going in that much, but just the threat. So he becomes like, in the way that sometimes people think about Korver or Redick, you know, like a real regular season guy. And I think this shifts in the playoffs some. So that's where I'll de-emphasize it a little. But in the regular season, when you got to come in on a night and you have to prepare all these different defensive actions with that guy, and you also have these three stars in the court, that's to me going to be some easy money. And the Laker coaching staff on the offensive side have to be excited about that, Pete.
I've been pining for a 3-point shooter that can shoot off of movement for years. This is like year three since we got LeBron, really. Because even though Wayne Ellington will never be the best player on the court for the Lakers, a player who can shoot off of screens and has gravity coming off of it, like if you don't defend it, he's going to kick your ass. That the chain reaction of that is one of the most important and beneficial things that you can have for a half-court offense. Like you said, it opens up the playbook. Him coming off of a stagger screen, or one of the reasons why, Darius, that he's so prolific above the break is because he usually starts out in the corner, but he's receiving a down screen. And so he's setting up his defender. And I loved teaching shooting. It was one of my favorite things to do when I coach. And he's just perfect technique, like foot between the defender's legs. He's leaning on him with the forearm, keeping him on his hip. And then he's going to explode off of that, going to run tight around that screen. So he's going to clip his shoulder on the hip of, or, you know, between the hip and the shoulder of the screen setter, not allowing any space for that lock and trail defender to squeeze through the screener and Ellington. And then as he comes off of that, he's able to hit that shot. If the defender, who's now a little bit behind him, is going to be frantically trailing because he knows, oh crap, I can't let, my job is to not let Wayne Ellington shoot. That's a scouting report, right? Make him go to the basket. It's easier said than done. So he's coming off as fast as he can to try and contest that shot. Again, Ellington has one of the best pump fakes in the league from the three-point line. So he's going to use that pump fake, and the guy's going to go flying by. He's going to rip over, have a nice open shot off of that. If that's Anthony Davis setting the screen, and then that's the big guy going, oh, crap, my lock and trail guy is in a bad spot. Or even if he's not, he's got to step up and show higher on that off-ball screen. If that's AD, every once in a while, AD's going to slip that. And one of the things that that really stood out to me from watching Ellington tape is every once in a while, he's gonna make some passes that are like, wow, that's a really nice pass. And a lot of those come off of his gravity as a shooter. So I am with you, Mike, on the de-emphasis come playoff time. We'll get into that more in the second segment. It has more to do with the defensive end, really. But he unlocks. We were rumored to be in the market for another off-screen shooter who I will not mention over the course of this summer. But I have been lusting after that type of guy, D, for years and years now, and I think that it just opens up our offense quite a bit. I'm fascinated to see what his role is, you know, in terms of the minutes he plays, what lineups he plays with, but that type of guy that you really have to account for coming off of a screen, the chain reaction of that is just beautiful.
Look, yes, the thing that I'm super interested with Ellington is that the Lakers set plenty of screens for shooters, but what they also do is they ask their guards to set a lot of screens because they're because the Lakers' best players are bigger players.
LeBron, one of our go-to actions is a guard setting a screen for – how many times did we see KCP set a screen for LeBron in the last 3 minutes of a close game in a fourth quarter?
It happens every game, yes. Right? Another one of the Lakers' pet actions is rather than – is they put AD in the corner, right? And so – and then – initiate to Bron at the elbow, right? And then that guard comes and sets, he takes the right angle and then he sets that screen for AD in the corner and AD rolls to the basket. And that's been a pet play for the Lakers basically since Vogel came on board. And it was usually Caruso who set that screen. Or sometimes it would be Rondo. Last year, it would be Dennis a lot that set that screen. But none of those guys are shooters. And so the idea of setting that screen is more like, okay, we know what's happening here. They're trying to get AD rolling to the basket. And how the Lakers would beat that sometimes is that AD would fade that screen instead. And he would pop to the corner. And now it's AD shooting a clean corner three. Well, you set that screen with a shooter the quality of Wayne Ellington, and now defending that action gets a lot harder because what defenses love to do is they love to put both players in the paint, right? And so, oh, my man, if I'm defending Alex Caruso and Alex Caruso goes to set that screen, I'm standing like in the dunker spot as Alex's defender. And I'm saying, all right, when AD comes off that screen, I'm chipping him and I'm trying to hold him up. So that
it's no question which guy you're going to go toward in that circumstance, right? Where do I shift my attention from and who do I shift it to? Obvious answer. When it's Wayne Ellington, much less.
Well, when it's Wayne Ellington, you still might say, well, holy shit, guys, this is Anthony Davis about to roll downhill. I have to stop him. Right? Anthony Davis getting a dunk is probably, that's the best play in the league there, right? If sure. Anthony Davis could dunk every time he got down the floor, he'd be Wilt Chamberlain, basically. He'd score 50 points a game. So stopping that is still super important. And that's what opens up Ellington after setting that screen, flaring back to the corner. And it sets up all of these great potential two-man game operations between Ellington and the guy you're trying to get downhill and rolling to the basket. You mentioned Kyle Korver earlier. Well, that action right there is a pet action from the old Cavs playbooks when they had Kevin Love and they had LeBron and they had Korver and they'd run that same exact action and it would be Love and Korver who would play two-man game in that corner. Now, both of those guys were shooting threats, but the ability to slip out of that or set guy screens for another, or it looks like I'm going to screen, but now we flop and now the big man is setting a screen for me instead and I'm popping to the corner. There's all kinds of little tricks that you can play with that action. And getting Ellington involved in screen actions where he's the purported screener rather than the screen receiver, that can also open up a ton of stuff within the Lakers playbook that they've tried to run in the past, right? But not to the same success that they have before. And so, yeah, man, get Ellington setting screens for LeBron, get him setting screens for Russell Westbrook, get him setting screens for Anthony Davis and see how that opens up shots for him. And that's just another element within the playbook that I know the Lakers coaches, I'm sure, are salivating over. Like, how can we get this guy open looks?
The other thing I think about with the Lakers specifically, and when you have a Lakers team with expectations to win, is that there's a lot of pressure to make shots and a lot of pressure to make open shots. And this is where I like the fact that Wayne Ellington is 33. You know, Ariza's 36. Melo, and, you know, we're going to talk about Monk in a second. But these, I like that Ellington has the confidence in his shot in multiple places now where I just don't think a cold spell is going to get to him. And he's played for the Lakers before. And he played, by the way, with Kobe Bryant. Now, it wasn't that many games. I think Kobe played 36 games or something, I want to say. I'd have to fact check myself that season, and I'll do that in a second. But that, I don't know, maybe that, for me, I think that gives you something else where he's, because we've seen players these last couple of years fall into some of these slumps. And that even included a guy like KCP, who is far from a rookie, but where those swings kind of could get there. So that settles me some also about Ellington and the shooting.
No, that's a great point. And I think that I actually think it's very possible that Ellington does hit a cold spell. But what I think is unlikely is that you see a team-wide cold spell to the degree that we saw last season.
He'll hit one, but I'm just saying he'll hit one, but I don't think he's going to worry about it that much. That's all I'm saying.
That's a great point, and he will always have gravity. There will be no point, like he could be 0 for 5 from 3. There's no point where it's like, leave Ellington open. It's not going to happen.
And okay, I was off a game. It was 35 games from Kobe.
Great memory. My concern, though, is on the defensive end. So let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit about Malik Monk and then both of these guys on the defensive end.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
So Malik Monk is a different type of shooter than Wayne Ellington. He's a much better athlete. He's smaller than Ellington. But the way that he gets his shots, he is an electric scorer. He's one of those guys that when he's on, he's more similar to Ben McLemore, who we had last year, who when we get to the defensive end, we'll talk some McLemore as well and make some parallels. But Monk is a guy who was a lottery pick in Charlotte. Then with the additions of Terry Rozier, Devontae Graham, LaMelo Ball, he found himself as the fourth guard. And I was actually very surprised that he signed with us on a vet minimum deal. I'm actually very curious about his playing time and what that looks like, because this was one of the things we talked about a couple pods ago, where if you're 23 years old, you're playing for your next contract. You're playing for the ability to continue in the NBA. And will he get the amount of opportunities and touches and ability to showcase what he does? That said, he's somebody who is, again, when he's on, he's an electric scorer. He's somebody who gets his shot up very quickly. He's got good footwork. And one of the things that I like is if he has a runway, he's a lob threat. So a lot of times the last couple of years, teams would jam us up D on our stagger screens. They would top lock those and not let the shooter use the screen, whether that was KCP, Avery Bradley, Danny Green, none of whom were really threats to come off of screens and knock those down to the level that Monk and especially Ellington is. Monk is okay on those. He's not great, but he's good. If you play too aggressively on Monk, he's got really good feel as a cutter and a back cutter and a good athlete in space. Now, he's small. If he's got any congestion or traffic in there, there's not going to be much in that respect. But curious, D, what are your thoughts on Malik Monk?
You covered a lot of it there, man. Like, to me, we were talking in a different pod, I think, about like Pelinka's philosophy around players and I had mentioned that they fall into a couple of different categories, and Monk to me fits the first category, which is a talent play. And I'm going to bring up another football reference, but Al Davis, he used to be owner of the Raiders and was also like a very good football guy. And so he was not only the owner, but he was someone who would influence personnel decisions for the Raiders. And Al Davis used to talk about how if there was a first round pick who like, or a high level guy who sort of didn't make it with his first team, he would always give, he would seek out those guys and he would give them a second chance with the Raiders, in this idea that talent always is sort of there, and maybe it just takes a different opportunity or a different location in order to bring that out. Now, Monk started to show flashes last season, and so if he had a good season for the Lakers this year, I don't think it would be a surprise. It would probably look like a continuation of what he did for the Hornets last season. But Monk was not good his first couple of years in the league. He was sort of, I don't want to say looked at as a bust, but he just didn't show what he showed at Kentucky. His backcourt partner, De'Aaron Fox, it really has sort of taken off as a young star within this league. And so when I look at Monk, I think, man, he's got a lot of tools as a scorer, and he can really get hot and influence a game from behind the arc. And even as a downhill scorer, I'm not sure how much that translates to a consistent role on this Lakers team, but he is definitely sort of that wild arm in the bullpen that you're just like, okay, well, let's bring out this dude who throws 100.
And let's
call on him and let's see if he can do something for us. Now, Mike, if that's indeed his role, what interests me is what I brought up a few pods ago, is when we were talking about Bazemore, is how does that sort of maybe inconsistency of role translate to performance? Because the Lakers have a lot of guards now, and they have a lot of guys. We just waxed poetically on Ellington and how valuable his skill as a shooter is. Well, Monk isn't quite the professional shooter that Ellington is, but he's got some professional scorer chops that the Lakers would be wise to invest in. But how much do you invest in that when you've got Anthony Davis and LeBron James? Like, this isn't developmental time. This is let's go win a championship time. And if I have any concerns about Monk, it's that, hey, is he going to get squeezed here because he is a little bit more of a wild card rather than an X factor, if that distinction makes sense.
Yeah, no, I'm kind of excited to talk about Monk. I'm excited to see him play, but let me start if I can with a quick story. So I was just in Summer League and I sat down to do a one-on-one with Austin Reeves that'll probably be out on my Twitter by the time this goes up. And Austin Reeves is from a tiny little town in Arkansas. Also from Arkansas, close to his age, actually exactly the same age, is Malik Monk. And so these two met in the championship game, the state championship game, when they were freshmen.
No kidding.
Yeah, and I have a link to it in the story, but there's a cool photo of it of freshman year Austin Reeves trying to defend freshman year Malik Monk. And so Reeves's team was so it was him, his best friend, they were freshmen, and they both had older brothers that were juniors. And his older brother, Austin Reeves' older brother, now plays professionally in Germany. And so like those two could ball, their friends could ball. And then they had a sophomore who was the other guy. And so they were like the all time chemistry cohesion team, knew exactly where they were going. And they just beat teams it wasn't like they weren't athletic at all. But anyway, so I'm asking him about this game and he's like, oh man, here, I'll just read the quote. We played them twice that year. We beat them both times. But if it was a one-on-one matchup, he definitely killed me. We played them in the state finals. I think he had like 27 as a freshman. He played really well. And so I said, yeah, I mean, Monk at the time, right, he was already starting to get all this national attention. And of course, he ends up going to Kentucky. So Reeves goes on. He says, yeah, top five, I think. We probably shouldn't have won that game. and his brother like got white hot, scored 29 in the second half. But so I can't wait to then ask Monk about it. But the point is, like, the pedigree for this kid goes back, and there's some, now I'm going to compare him in a way to Kuzma to answer the question. So Kuzma didn't have the pedigree, but we watched him at Summer League. We watched him early that season, and oh, this guy can score. Like, this guy's got some stuff. He's got weaknesses. He's not really doing much on defense. You know, I don't know about the consistency, but there's this talent that popped out, even though it happened in a different way. And that's part of what I'm kind of thinking when Monk comes in, and there's going to be some spots where he's got a little more burst than you think. Like, he was a dunker for a while. And now we think about him with the shooting last year. But so there's going to be some stuff that we see. But at 23, think about how much better Kuzma got at the other stuff by sitting in the film room with LeBron and with all now the other five Hall of Famers that are on the roster. And so I'm curious to see what he didn't have a lot of vets. He was one of the older players in Charlotte. He didn't have a lot of vets there. Yeah. And so that's where I don't know how it's going to look early. I think we'll more see it in spots. Oh, well, okay. He had 20 in a preseason game. Like, that's exciting. But then he had two the next game. But what parts of the talent there can be grown, can be what parts of that plant can be watered, and can that develop to the point where by playoff time there is kind of a consistent spot for him to come in and contribute? Like, that's why I'm excited and curious, because there is plenty of talent there that can be utilized.
And his circumstances are so different. You really covered a big portion of that with the difference in vets that we have versus, and I think that's part of the reason he signed here, right? Is that ability to be, he mentioned that in his introductory press conference, was the being in this environment was a real opportunity for him. Of the guys that I met that day, he was probably the person that impressed me the most. Just I'm very intrigued by Monk and why he's here, what he wants to do in his time here. From watching tape on him, he shoots, like, not all 40% shooters are created equal. This dude shoots really difficult threes, or at least did in Charlotte. And he shot more of them than he should have. When he gets a good shot that is open, I don't know, the type of shots that LeBron James and Russell Westbrook and even to an extent Anthony Davis create, that dude is money. And I think that he is going to be an important, if nothing else, if he's an important regular season player. So many of these pods have been like, oh, we got this OG Trevor Ariza and Carmelo Anthony and even a Dwight Howard and Russell Westbrook, LeBron James, all these older players. A guy who can run and fill a lane and just has some burst to carry us through those 82 games, Darius. Even if he doesn't have playoff value, I think that will have value for the playoffs, even if it's if it's less direct and more toward the other players on the team.
A few pods ago, you asked me, what style of play do I see the Lakers playing? And I said, this team is built to run. Right.
Absolutely.
Well, of all of the guys that the Lakers signed this offseason, right, there's Russ. Obviously, you think of like, oh, that dude. Yeah. He's built to run. Right. After that, none. I like his transition game.
Bazemore. Right? I like Bazemore in transition. Yeah.
Bazemore in transition. Monk, to me, he's the guy who excites me the most when I think of transition stuff out of all of the free agent acquisitions. Russ is obviously the guy who excites me the most. But I'm thinking of lineups where we've talked about, like, oh, who's going to start? And, like, all of these guys are a given, right? Like, there's three guys who are a given, and who are the other two guys, right? Well, imagine a lineup with LeBron and AD and Russ and then Malik Monk. And the transition opportunities that exist with that sort of team and the shot creation ability that exists with that sort of lineup. And the idea of, all right, man, like, who are you going to guard? Like, how do you take it all away? And I get, like, oh, well, spacing and, oh, shrink the floor. Like, I get it. And I'm using a tone there that sort of is like mocking those ideas. Well, yeah, that stuff's a lot easier when the defense is set and when you've got a bunch of time to set up. Well, what if you don't have time to get set? What if you're scrambling in early offense situations? And what if you're like, oh, okay, well, suddenly you've got some cross-matched power forward who's running back, and the first guy up the court is Malik Monk. That used to happen for KCP too. And he would sprint deep corner, and it's just like, okay, well, first guy back, you better get out there, right? LeBron is throwing ahead. This upcoming season, LeBron's going to be throwing ahead still. Russ is going to throw ahead still, right? And these guys, a guy like Monk excites me within the context of he is, like I said, a wild card. You don't exactly know what he's going to do on any given possession. And that uncertainty, while it can work against you, and I think we need to be cautious of looking at all of this stuff through upside only and 100%. Not downside, right? Because there's downside to a lot of this stuff too. But the upside in some of these acquisitions, Monk especially, is super intriguing to me because when you look at the baseline level of talent that the Lakers already have, throwing in a guy like this who is super talented, who is still finding his way in the league, if he starts to put it together a little bit more and can build on his last season, you may have something here. And it's one of those good problems to have, Mike, where it's just like, oh yeah, let's go to Malik Monk and maybe he gets another. Maybe he gets a second or a third shift this game because he's got it going. And the talent you can call on then can really be a difference in a mid-February game where maybe the rest of the legs for those vets are tired. But here's 23, 24-year-old Malik Monk just, hey, I got energy for days.
No question. And like that's with Monk and the whole way that he played last year in Charlotte, I also don't know if that was optimal for him. But then we get to the point where, all right, if you're in your fourth year, there's a part of whatever you do that it's your job to make the coach give you those spots. So mm-hmm. this is kind of gets back to the cautionary part of this, where if Charlotte wanted to keep him, then they probably would have done something different, either played him more or, you know, they would have done something while he was there. So they're not, everything was great. And that's part of it that we have to acknowledge. Anytime you pick up a guy that is off of a rookie deal, that it's not all just roses. You have to kind of understand that there are some thorns there. Yeah.
I think he's a specialist. He's a shooter. He's a guy who can put the ball in the bucket and doesn't contribute a ton in other aspects of the game. There's a place for that in the league. It's just a question of where is that? And I think on a team like ours, where we have so many shot creators, Malik Monk will make the types of shots that our shot creators create. He also has a little bit of ability to put the ball on the deck and adds to that whole idea I was talking about, that our dribbling just across the board is really improved. That said, though, the defensive end, and this applies to Monk and Ellington, I don't know who these guys guard in the playoffs, to be perfectly frank. I think Ellington, just by virtue of his size, is likelier. He can chase guys off of screens, but in the playoffs, especially when I anticipate we'll be switching a decent amount, that is a skill that matters, but not as much, because you're not in as many drop coverages and the different lock and trail situations that you aren't in defenses that require lock and trails. Where are you at on that? Because from watching tape on them, I don't see the playoff translation, but maybe I'm being harsh there.
No, these guys aren't good defenders. Like, I mean, we sound like a broken record on all of these pods, but yeah. Mike made this point a few pods ago, and it's going to be the point that we make all season, is that the guys who were available for the Lakers to get, they skew way more offense, and those are the guys that were out there. And those were the guys who came on minimum contracts. And if you could get an effective two-way player who was going to be a high-level playoff contributor on both sides of the ball, and you could get him for the minimum, then you probably cheated in some way, shape, or like, I don't know. That's like 2K stuff, right? Or you're best friends with the agent. Like, I honestly don't know how those guys are available. They're not. And so the Lakers clearly made a calculation, like, we're going to get offensive players. These are the guys who are available, but they're also the highest talent plays that we could get for this. And so who are they going to guard? I mean, they're going to try to guard the guy in front of them. They're probably not going to be very good at it. Sorry. I don't know what to say about that. The part that interests me more is how quickly can they adapt to the team defense concepts, right?
Do your job type stuff, yes.
Yes, like, are you going to be in the right place? Are you going to make the right rotation, right? Or are you and your other wing teammate who are on the weak side, are you not going to X out correctly? Are you both going to run to the same guy? Are you where you're supposed to be on the back line? Are you boxing out? Are you tagging appropriately? Are you tagging and recovering? Are you making all the in-play rotations that help string out a defensive possession where you then let your better defensive players thrive? Yes. When they need to, because
this is where our success lies. Yes.
Because if you can't do those things, you're not going to play at all. It's like, sorry, I don't care how explosive you are offensively. I don't care how many shots you can make. Frank Vogel is basically going to say, who can I trust to not mess up a defensive possession? And if you could be one of those players who he can trust to not mess up, like, you don't got to go out there and be freaking Tony Allen. Defensively, what you need to do is be the guy who doesn't show up on tape over and over and over again as the dude who's being spotlighted as the guy who can't be trusted. And that's what's going to be important for all of these dudes.
So, by the way, good professional broadcasting by you guys, because my 1-year-old just came in here and was making all kinds of giggly faces and you guys just kept straight forward going while making smiles at the baby. So respect to you for that. I was thinking... As you were doing that, there are these different ways and schemes, right, that the Lakers can come up with, that Frank Vogel certainly can come up with, to either hide or just protect the players that have these deficiencies you're talking about. But I think you're right. When it comes down to it, the easier thing to do is just play the guy that's a little bit worse on offense, but you don't have to worry about on defense. And that's why I sometimes think about before the Lakers got good and when they had all the young guys, and there's something about Josh Hart that I really liked in this instance, because I'm like, you know what? I just kind of feel like I can trust him defensively and offensively. Sure, you know, he might be streaky and he might miss a bunch of shots, but there's just something about him in that setting where I might prefer, and maybe Bazemore is the equivalent, even though he's a vet now, where like there's that guy in the playoffs that I don't have to take off the floor because the other coach isn't going to hunt him. And that right there is what the Lakers have less of this year than what they had last year. And that's the whole formula that we saw work around LeBron and AD. And now this has shifted. So do they have enough of those guys? And we right now, you know, it doesn't seem like Ellington and Monk are going to be in that category. The last pod that we did, Ariza and Melo. Now, maybe Ariza, you know, but like Melo, no. So are there enough guys there? And if not, does the offense overwhelm and is it just fine because of that? Maybe. And if the answer is no to both of those things, that's when you got to figure out if there's a trade to be made around the next trade deadline. And you know what? We got to have one more guy. Frank Vogel says, I need one more guy who I can trust and I can just leave out there defensively. And that's how you go about it. But this is fine. Like they may have enough right now to win the title. And if not, we should know by the point that they can do something about it. And so that's overall why I will continue to feel good about what this situation is. And it's interesting to look at it through the lens of Ellington and Monk and think about all of the stuff we just discussed.
100%. And when you zoom out, there hasn't been a version of the Lakers roster that at this point of the season, and even as we record this, we have open roster spots, but there hasn't been even on opening night, the same team that ended up in the playoffs. So there are more moves likely to be made, more. And like you said, Mike, that first part of the season is seeing how it all works together. I'm sure they've had countless hours between Pelinka and Vogel and LeBron and AD and all of the different leaders on the team theorizing how this guy will fit in just as we are. But seeing it on the court, you see how, you know, 70% of it is correct, but maybe 30% of it is not, or it's a little bit different than you anticipated. And we will be in the position to make adjustments to fill in the holes that I think that we have. Your point about trust, though, is something that I don't think that people realize how important that is for a coach, of just like, can I trust you to be in the right spot? And while you can scheme to a certain degree, there are so many situations in an NBA game where it's just up to the player to make the correct decision. Like, the coach can draw it up and be like, you're supposed to go here. But there are so many scramble situations and so many points where you not only have to apply the scheme, but also in the moment be like, oh, the ball moved from here to there to that guy, and therefore I need to be dropping down because this guy's a lob threat. You know,
I've got twin 6 year olds, as we all know. I can teach them. I can tell them how many times, don't pee on the toilet seat, bro. Okay. Pick it up. And if you do it, we all drip a little bit. That's fine. Wipe it away. They're still six. I get it. It's cool. But by the time they get to be the age of like Darius's oldest, we're going to have a problem if we're still pee on the toilet seat every time I sit down on it.
And I trust a 33-year-old Wayne Ellington to not pee on the toilet seat more than a 23-year-old Malik Monk. That is the point I was getting at. So thank you for a perfect analogy for that.
This idea, too, of where is the absence of mistakes going to come from? And that idea of trust is also, it comes down to instincts. Like, what are your basketball instincts? And when it's time to make a play in front of you, can you actually summon the timing and the experience and the know-how that is out there in the ether? Can you grab it and apply it to yourself and say, I'm there to make the play? And Vogel, in the championship season, he trusted two or three guys to make those plays, and he was rewarded with that trust. Last season, we all know that things did not go as he would have liked. And I think that he, by the end of the season, in that last game six, he was searching still for guys that he could trust, because he had gone through an entire year and never really quite found it because of injury, because of roster turnover and all of that. And so we will see if he finds guys that he deems have that in them to trust, because I think that's one of Vogel's best qualities, is that when he believes in you, that belief is not going to die. It's not going to be extinguished, and he will follow you into the fire and say, I'm right here with you. I believe in you. Go get the job done. I know that you can. And to Mike's point, I'll be interested to see if by the time the trade deadline comes, he might be up in Rob's office and saying, I don't have enough of these guys that I can trust. And that's the interesting part of the coaching lens and everything that we're doing now and how it's going to play out in September and October and then hopefully into June.
That's exactly what this first part of the season is for, is answering those questions. And so this wraps up, at least for now, our little general overviews of the new guys that we acquired. We're not going to do a pod on Dwight, although we'll talk about him certainly throughout the season. Laker fans are pretty familiar with his game. Although, you know, 2 years ago, things do change. Next week's going to be Westbrook week. We're going to get into our five most burning questions and subtopics on Westbrook and really get in the weeds, because as we talk about all of the role players that we talked about this week, they're all important. They will all have a job and a place in the story of the Lakers season. In my eyes, Russell Westbrook is far and away the biggest X factor in how this season goes, and how he performs and how well he fits in is more important than probably all of those guys combined. So I'm really excited to get more into the weeds on him, and we'll do that next week on the Laker Film Room Podcast.
James has got it in low to McHale. McHale wants to turn, he's double team. Just pass out of front, broken up by Worthy. Tip to Magic. Worthy dies on his belly. Magic scores.
Yes, Magic got it. Magic fires again. The Lakers win the game. The Lakers win the game. Rebound to Lottie. 3 seconds left.
Van
Exel to win it. It's on the way.
Good! Kobe Bryant, 48 points, 16 rebounds. With his eighth block shot that ties an NBA Finals record.
A lot of Laker fans sticking around for this.
You're seeing something that's very rare indeed. A Laker to get MVP chance.
Right, in Boston.
In Boston.
Of all places.
Are you kidding me?
Kobe. Hard to believe.
Are you kidding me? Unreal! Are you kidding me?
Lakers looking to push. Bryant spinning in the lane, back for Gasol, pretty pass, and it's back to a three-point game.
Kobe Bryant picked up by Bell.
There's the move. Two, one, miss it.
Unbelievable.
For the victory. It's over.
Shot clock now to five. Bryant.
Yeah.
And that was a little tough to Alvin Gentry.
Add insult to injury, Kobe. I mean, what a shot. I mean, you can't defend that. Are you kidding me?
2.1 seconds remaining. Denver a foul to give. Jokic trying to disrupt Rondo. He puts it in. Here's Davis, 4-3 in the win. Oh, it's good! Anthony Davis has won it for the Lakers! James again. Oh, he hits another one. LeBron James putting together a closing quarter against the Nuggets.
This historic 2020 NBA championship belongs to the Los Angeles Lakers. The Lakers conquer the bubble, and banner number 17 will soon hang in the rafters.